I'm delighted to welcome back into the studio Stephen De Silva, who is, as he explained himself last time, a cathedral warden and a guide to the Abbey and Cathedral of St. Albans. We're going to chat today a little bit more about the role of St. Albans in the time leading up to Magna Carta, because we are this year in the 800th anniversary of Magna Carta. Stephen, tell me a little bit about the role of St. Albans. Why did I say that?
Well, there are a group of towns in England associated with Magna Carta, so they're known as charter towns. And St. Albans is one of the charter towns because our historical records in the cathedral, the annals of the abbey, if you like, record the fact that in August 1213, so that's 2 years before King John agrees to Magna Carta, in August 1213, there is a meeting of barons and churchmen at St. Albans Abbey to discuss their grievances.
Did the king know they were meeting?
That's a good question. I'm not sure about that. Certainly, he was conscious that people were fulminating against him, so I suspect he was aware that, that meetings were taking place.
Because this is King John, who was not generally recognised as being a very good king.
No, a pretty erratic king. I mean, you know, it's hard to make these judgments, but if you actually look at his exercise of justice and his treatment of prisoners, he's a pretty erratic person, still relying very much on the royal prerogative to do this, that, the other, put someone in prison. He particularly put to death one of a noble woman and her son in particularly unpleasant ways. I mean, virtually kind of starved to death. So he was not liked. He was seen as a difficult person. So both barons and churchmen felt that he was infringing their liberties.
Yes. Was he also creating fiscal problems? He was spending a lot of money. I mean,
great deal of money. There were things that were going to be done in the cathedral here, the abbey here, which didn't happen because of the king's just demand for funds and taxation. Very random taxes being applied to people who really resented paying it, as you can imagine. So it's not a surprise that people are fulminating against and building up this tidal wave of over years, as we can see, 1213 to 1215, this kind of decision to finally force the king's hand.
Okay, so they come to the abbey and was among other places as
yes.
when they get together, and they're chatting there, and they're drawing up the agenda, or they're...
It would be too much to say that any document was produced. There's no evidence for a document. I mean, bless them, in the old days, I think cathedral guides used to say Magna Carta was drafted at St. Albans. I think we have to lay that one aside now. It's a lovely idea, but it probably isn't true. They may simply have had a discussion. The equivalent of minutes might have been kept. Perhaps some of those things discussed did end up becoming phrases and clauses in the document itself, but we can't make that connection between any document and Magna Carta.
Mm. Now, these were the barons looking after their own interests and the clergy looking after their own interests.
Yes, absolutely.
So two big power structures, as it were, and looking at how they can take it out on the third big power structure called the monarchy.
Indeed. I mean, that's really that's the power structure of England, isn't it? You know, fundamentally, you have these... The church has its liberties and freedoms. The barons are growing increasingly independent-minded. The further you get from the Norman conquest, the more a sense of Englishness is developing amongst the barons, even though they are, of course, many of them are descended from the original Norman settlers. They have French names, that kind of thing. There's a sense in which the barons are growing in power. A weak and erratic king, not surprisingly, becomes a target for that kind of political growth by the barons. The church sees itself as defending its liberties because John is also infringing on the liberties of the church.
And both bodies would presumably have argued that they were doing this on behalf of the people, or did they not even make that sort of statement?
There's some sense in which this is the freedom of Englishmen to do this in this country. No, they don't even pretend that they're acting on behalf of the common man. I think man in those days is seen as those of us who are literate and meeting and talking. The serfs, the vassals, we're not really thinking of them.
Okay. So they get together and they get some ideas and they let off some steam, presumably at the same time, and that managed one. Therefore, over the next 2 years, do they go on rumbling and grumbling?
Yes, there are further meetings in other places. Eventually, there is the beginning of a drafting process that takes place, which produces the document that we can call the Great Charter, Magna Carta. And that is, as we know, brought to Runnymede in June 1215 for the king to agree.
Well, he agreed under some sort of duress, I guess.
Indeed,
I
mean, yes.
I mean, you might want to tell why Runnymede was chosen. I've heard it's because the horses couldn't... a swamp is a good place to have a meeting because you can't have a fight.
Quickly. Well, there's speculation that that's the case. It's near Windsor, of course, so it's near the court. Yeah. There are a range of things happening. But the king is clearly metaphorically pinned down, if not physically pinned down, and forced to agree. Partially because he needs the support of the ruling classes to continue his own campaigns. And he has great difficulty getting that support without, in return, making some concession to them. And so certain concessions are there. The freedom of the church, for example, to act free of the king is an important part of Magna Carta. No arbitrary throwing into prison of people without a right of trial. Again, we're talking about free men, not serfs and vassals. Mm-hmm. Clearly, the barons carried on that kind of throwing people into their own prisons, mm-hmm. With any impunity, I suspect. But for the barons themselves, no one should be imprisoned without trial. A range of these things have come down to us as the real key freedoms of Magna Carta.
I mean, it's not like a list of items, is it? It's more or less one continuous document.
It's a continuous document. It is not punctuated in paragraphs, for example. So when I saw it 2 years ago when we had the best copy here in St. Albans, it was interesting how tightly written it is. It is really just a series of clauses. So they are actually itemed clauses, number after number, of what should or shouldn't take place.
When you rightly said that, of course, it came to St. Albans a couple of years ago.
Yes, we get the Lincoln copy at St. Albans. There are four or five extant copies, probably the clearest of which is the Lincoln one. Mm. The Lincoln one's fascinating. It's been in Lincoln since Magna Carta. It actually has the name of the Bishop of Lincoln on the outside, indicating that he probably took it with him to Lincoln.
And Magna Carta stand means the sort of the Great Charter.
The Great Charter, yes. And there were other charters. There was the Charter of the Forest, the Charter of Henry I. There were a range of charters. This one has gone down in history as the Great Charter because I suppose it's the great summary of all of the things that the king must do in order to have the consent of the people to rule.
And is it sort of one side in that sense, it's the things the king must do? Does it say what the barons must do in return, or are the limits on the king's power?
It isn't always the king must or must not do something, but these things shall happen in England. It might be the best way to describe it. And therefore, neither the king nor the barons nor anyone else shall stop these things happening in England. But chiefly it's aimed at the king, yes.
Okay. So it's sort of an early Bill of Rights. That's the wrong phrase, isn't it?
Because it's not a bad one. Certainly the Americans, who take Magna Carta much more seriously than sometimes we have in England, Runnymede, the memorial at Runnymede was founded by the American Bar Association, not by the English. They see it very much as a precursor of the Bill of Rights. They would see it as the earliest time that the rights of the citizens were enumerated and set out. So they see Magna Carta as a really important foundation document for freedoms. Mm. So that's not a bad analogy.
So that was it. It was all done and dusted, and the king's hands were tied, and the barons were happy, and the clergy went off happy?
For a few months. The king then immediately revoked it when he had the upper hand again. He dies not that long afterwards. Subsequent kings, it's then brought to subsequent kings who were far more amenable and tactful than King John ever was. He really was quite an interesting character. And it is reinstated into British law two or three times. It's revised and added to as time goes on. But that particular document of 1215 is the beginning of all of that.
And is that why we have that? Although there were later documents.
It's why that one is focused on. It's seen as the moment at which the king needs, in some sense, the consent of the people, the church and the barons, to rule. He cannot rule exclusively of his own, and that's the beginning of the rights and freedoms.
And of course that problem goes on, because if you then get to Charles I...
Absolutely. Yes, you have subsequent appeals to Magna Carta, and looking back to Magna Carta throughout English history, it falls out of favour, then it comes back into favour. But you're absolutely right. You come to the point of Charles I where the limitations are insufficient, and so there is in effect an English revolution. But then you have the 1688, the Glorious Revolution, when the real English, bill of rights and freedoms is drawn up and is formally agreed by William and Mary. So Magna Carta is a very early precursor of centuries of balancing royal and civic power.
And it's, I mean, we're talking currently about the, you know, whether we will keep the Human Rights
Act. Yeah, as we were talking, that was in the back of my head. Absolutely.
The British Bill of Rights, whatever. I mean, presumably it will draw upon whatever we have, whether we have the European one or the British one, will have some sense of these fundamental rights that...
I don't know the European one well enough to say whether it draws much on Magna Carta, but I think it would be, I'd be very surprised if, in a sense, Magna Carta isn't breathing behind it, if that makes sense. It would be interesting to see if we had then have a British one. I would hope it would make reference to and draw upon Magna Carta, if only because the politicians responsible for it are good historians and should be aware. Unlike, oh dear, this is an unkind story, isn't it? But unlike Mr. Cameron, who couldn't remember what Magna Carta meant, I think Mr. Gove... will indeed make some reference to Magna Carta if he's responsible for drawing it up.
So we've got this great anniversary this year of Magna Carta. That itself links to the 802nd year since the meeting in the Abbey.
Yes, indeed.
A lot of other things happened in between, I guess, in the Abbey. That was fair. I mean, it was never pulled down by Henry, it was never destroyed by Henry VIII, was it?
Of course, everything else was. The church building wasn't destroyed by Henry VIII, but you have to remember the whole of that hillside was covered in monastic buildings, and those buildings were sold off to Sir Richard Lee. He was given permission to take all of the stone for building, because Hertfordshire is not a good place for stone quarrying, so if you've got stone, you reuse it. Richard Lee takes everything bar the church itself and the Great Gateway, of course. The gateway becomes the town prison. The church becomes the parish church for the town. But in the 19th century, a discovery was made under one of the corners of the tower, which indicates perhaps at the time of the dissolution, there was an attempt to bring the whole church down. One of the tower piers had been burrowed under in a fire set to try and weaken the tower. So... I wonder if Richard Lee quite fancied taking the church as well.
the church, yes, the whole thing.
The whole thing, yes. If the tower had fallen, there weren't the resources in the small town of St. Albans to rebuild that.
Yes.
And so Richard Lee, I think, could probably have claimed, that's fallen in as well. Now, I might as well have that as well for a little bit more.
Yes, you referred to it as a small town. Of course, now it's a large city by comparison.
It is.
Although it's not a massively large, it's limited by the green belt around it, but which is fortunate for us. It's one of the places that people visit from all over the world?
They do, but not in sufficiently large numbers. We did a survey last summer, just surveying some of the visitors who came to the cathedral, and in the space of, I think we only did a week, we had about 50 or 60 countries represented in the survey. So undoubtedly, but a lot of our visitors are local. Well, we're talking about the cathedral now. The city tourist board might have a different perception of the city itself. But in the cathedral, a lot of our visitors are still relatively local. We don't see the numbers of overseas visitors that we would like to see. And so we're working hard currently, as you probably picked up, with a Heritage Lottery Fund project to try and increase our welcome facilities, but also to make the story of St. Alban and St. Albans better known. I think it's one of England's best-kept secrets. You know, Americans discover it and rave about it and knew nothing about it. They stumbled on it by accident.
Well, if you go back to what we were talking about last time, we have the first Christian martyr. And is it the oldest continuous site of Christian worship?
Oh, undoubtedly, yes. Canterbury is a mere parvenu. I mean, a newcomer in it all. Because of the way we know Christians worshipped around the graves of the martyrs, I don't think I have any hesitation in saying Christian worship has happened here since Alban's death. So 1,700 years of Christian worship on that hillside. There's just nowhere else in the British Isles that can make that claim.
But Canterbury is, for example, how...
Canterbury, we're looking at the 6th century onwards, see. So 300, 400 years later.
So it's quite an important little
it's
city.
A very, it really is. It's one of the great gems of England that we just have to make better known.